down shortly here, and H minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is the 19th of November in the glorious future year of 2022. Now, you may have heard that the United States launched a rocket to the moon the other day. And you might think that I would be just overjoyed by this. Well, to a certain extent I am, you know. Anytime anybody's doing anything like this, I'm all for it. But to an extent I have to admit, I take a somewhat more nuanced view. And what do I mean by a somewhat more nuanced view? Well, so 13 years ago, when SLS was still called Ares 5, and the Artemis project was still called the Constellation Program, we had something called the U.S. Review of Human Spaceflight Plans Committee here in the United States. And I got up ungodly early on one morning, and I drove, in fact, I can even tell you what day, I got up ungodly early on a Tuesday morning and drove like a bat out of hell to get to League City, Texas, which is on the bay side of Houston. It's not even on the land side. It's on the bay side of Houston. And I sat there. Well, I sat there very uneasily because I had a terrible headache. Their lights, between the early morning, I suppose, and various other phenomena, and the lights, which were like little stabbing pencil rays pointed into the audience, I had a god-awful headache, and I kept having to duck out of the room because I thought I was going to vomit the whole time. Anyway, so when the public comment period came around, I gave my testimony. I don't think I did it very effectively, but I did give. I was the first person in line to give testimony. And it's interesting that a year later in Australia, at the World Science Fiction Convention there, I had somebody come up to me and slap me on the back and say, "Hey, I saw your testimony before the Augustine Committee, and I really want to thank you for saying that. I thought it was really cool." And I was just blown away because, as I said, I thought I did fairly badly, because I wasn't feeling well. Matter of fact, at one point, and I'm not proud to say this, I really thought I was going to throw up all over Apollo flight controller Gene Kranz and Skylab astronaut Owen Garriott, father of private astronaut Richard Garriott and famous video game designer, anyway, who were both there and who were talking in the lobby at one point when I ducked out to get a little relief for my head. But yeah, I was in and out of that hearing room the whole time. And I was making mental notes as to what I should say, but as you can imagine, my mind was in such disorder from the headache that I don't think I was very effective. You can, however, judge for yourself. I'm going to drop the link into Calm, and I also included it in the Anon Radio post for today. So you can actually you can actually see what I said, hear what I said, or at least part of it. The video is kind of badly edited. The original video is on Vimeo, and then somebody translated it to translated it to YouTube. If you don't have a Vimeo account, you can't actually watch the video because it's listed as unrated, and they don't let you do that anymore. They don't let you watch those videos unless you're logged in, because it could be naughty. It's a U.S. government agency, for God's sake. Why they didn't have this on some kind of U.S. government website, I'll never know. Anyhow, but I was very impressed that morning because Sally Ride, sadly no longer with us, the great Sally Ride, the thing you have to understand, for all that I complain about the National Agency for Space Avoidance, the plain fact is they hire some incredibly competent people, and they give those people really complex and difficult stuff to do, and they do it well. And so much of the space program, the nuts and bolts, the day-to-day stuff, is actually run by the people with the astronaut wings. They're the ones who are put in charge of this stuff. On a sort of a line management basis. They don't make the decisions, but they do a hell of a lot to make sure that things get delivered, because at the end of the day, if you're going to be the one in the capsule, you want to be the one walking along the line, or somebody else is going to be in there with you, walking along the line, watching it be assembled. Anyhow, but Sally Ride got up and she said, "This Constellation program is slipping by 18 months a year," which is to say that at the end of a given year, the schedule wasn't 12 months ahead of where it had been at the beginning of the year. It was 18 months behind. Well, I mean, at that point, you know, it's not going to get done before the Trump of Doom. And that was the advice the Obama administration relied on when they said, "We're going to cancel Ares Orion, this whole Constellation program, and we're going to instead farm out to private corporations to build basic capabilities. And then once we have those basic capabilities, we can do more interesting stuff." And a lot of people screamed and cried about it. They said, "Oh no, you're killing the space program! These goddamn liberals killing the space program!" Well, I mean, they're the people who went and gave Elon Musk the money to build the Falcon Heavy and the Dragon capsule. And of course, Dragon is routinely delivering people to the International Space Station, while neither Orion nor the Boeing CST-100, now rebranded Starliner, is doing anything of the kind. You know, and likewise, Orbital Sciences has delivered payloads to the space station, this kind of thing. So I thought that this is NASA getting a lot more bang for the buck, because let's be blunt, it's been 20 years now since Mike Griffin, who was, I have to say this, a hell of a lot better engineer than he ever was an administrator, chaired this study and came up with this Constellation program, which is going to have a 7-man Apollo-derived capsule. And I've been told, informally, right, but I've been told by someone who would know, that the one rationale for setting that 7-man capacity, which of course has now been downrated to 4, it has to be made clear, was so that the heat shield would be large enough in diameter that it couldn't be put on an existing launch vehicle. Namely, one of the EELVs, the Atlas V or the Delta IV, that the Air Force had already paid to have developed. It would need its new launch vehicle. That new launch vehicle would be a quick and cheap shuttle-derived component using some leftover Apollo hardware, basically a shuttle solid rocket booster with a retread Apollo-derived upper stage, and then you'd have a second bigger vehicle which would lift stuff like the lunar lander into orbit, and that would be based on a shuttle external tank. And anyway, the whole thing didn't work. It just plain didn't work. And it's been revised and revised and revised. They've taken the space shuttle main engines, RS-25 space shuttle main engines, which were designed for reusability, and they've turned them into expendable engines. In what universe does this make even the slightest iota of sense, I ask you? And the thing is, it was supposed to be, right, it was supposed to be quick and cheap. 20 years have passed while it crawled its way to the pad. So yeah, I'm glad, right? I'm glad that that capsule is on its way to the moon, but for God's sake, the amount of money that's been spent on it and the amount of time that it's taken, I could have 100 people living permanently on the lunar surface by now. If I'd started in 2010, not 2001, if I'd cut that time in half, right? If I'd started in 2010, 11, 12, right? Say 10 years ago, not 20, 10 years ago. And I'd had half the budget they had, I would be on the moon right now, and there would be 50 or 100 people there with me. So yeah, I'm not opposed in any way, shape, or form to the Artemis program, but, you know, NASA says their main objective is to put the first woman and the first person of color on the moon. I'm pretty sure that I can find a black woman to accompany me to the moon. I'm pretty sure I can scoop them. And what happens then? You know, doing anything real in space is going to require Congress to commit to some real, sustained effort. And Congress has not shown that willingness. So, about the most positive thing that I can say, that I can express about this whole Artemis program, is guarded optimism. Because, ultimately, you know, SLS is not even intended to do more than about one flight a year, and that's assuming everything goes according to plan. You're not going to accomplish much of anything, right, at that kind of flight rate. We could be doing Falcon Heavy flights every month. I want you to think about that. Now, aside from that, right, so I teased this broadcast by saying, if you give me money, what will I use it to buy? Fountain pens, nuclear power plants, spaceships, books? This is, of course, a trick question. What have I bought recently? I went out and I bought a fountain pen yesterday. I went out to get the battery on my pocket watch changed. And I got the fountain, and I bought a fountain pen while I was out. Today, I received in the mail a thing that I bought the other day, which is a box of matches. And not a little, you know, pocket match box, but like a kitchen match box. Which was some kind of souvenir of the Obergheim nuclear power plant. And I bought it not just because it has a picture of the plant on the front, but also it has a data table on the back. Very curious. And of course, books. You know, spaceships, books, nuclear power plants, fountain pens. It's basically, you know, you take your pick. Whatever money I get, I buy the first thing that I see. And this is just because as a coin collector, I'm well aware that all currencies lose their value sooner or later. So I might as well just, buy that thing now. But where was I? So yes, I got kind of mad yesterday because while I was out, I was in the subway. You understand, this is how I get around when I'm in Munich. I get around by public transit. They have an excellent subway system and an excellent tram system. Unfortunately, the tram to where I was going had been discontinued because of construction, but it just was in easy walking distance of a subway stop, so I took the subway instead. And in the subway, you can pick up copies of something called M-Pulse, which is a little newsletter put out by the Stadtwerke München. And the Stadtwerke München is the municipal utility, which is responsible for street lighting and electricity supply in most parts of the city, and water supply in most parts of the city, and sewer in most parts of the city, and in some parts of the city, district heating, and in some parts of the city, even district cooling. So they do a whole bunch of stuff. Oh, and internet. They're also an ISP. And I guess they probably also handle telephone calls? I suppose. Anyway, so there's this leaflet, which I picked up here in the subway, in the subway station, because they put it there. And I'm leafing through it, and I'm thinking, I'm having a brain aneurysm here. Why do I say that? Well, I mean, so there's a nice little thing from Dr. Florian Bieberbach, who's the head of the organization, all about, you know, the front cover says, Gemeinsam handeln, wie wir mit der Energiekrise umgehen können. All about the energy crisis, right? And then there's this message from Dr. Bieberbach, talking about how we have to save every kilowatt hour, and you'll find plenty of valuable energy-saving tips in this volume. And then immediately below the message from Dr. Bieberbach is a thing talking about how you can get a subsidy from the SWM, a subsidy of 320 euros a year if you buy an electric car. This is, and because the use of electric automobiles allows you to reduce your carbon dioxide emissions and therefore protect the climate. Of course, using an electric car is going to cause a greater drain on these precious kilowatt hours. So that's kind of confusing. It seems like just a little bit, I don't know, contradictory. And then I'm turning over here on page 12, there's a thing talking about how district heating is carbon dioxide neutral. On the same page, in a context which makes it clear it was written by the same person, is the message saying we're trying very hard to save natural gas so that we can use less gas. We have delayed the decommissioning or taking out of service of the coal-fired electric power and district heating plant, which was to have been replaced by a gas-fired electric and district heating plant, and therefore we have acquired some more coal to burn, and also we have reactivated formerly shut down oil burners, and we have laid in a good supply of heating oil. Now, that's the prudent thing to do, but it's not exactly climate neutral. Burning coal, burning heating oil, Jesus Christ, people. You're telling me that that's climate neutral. I have doubts. You know, there's a thing in here talking about how great, talking about your, you know, how great the Energiewende, the German energy transition is going, you know, and how great it is, renewable energies, and there's lots of reasons to like them, but, you know, if they're saying they're replacing, you know, we've delayed replacing coal and oil with gas. Well, none of that is exactly renewable energy, is it? You know, and they talk about, oh, we've got renewable energy from your region. And there's a photo of water power station Isar 1. Now, you can tell by looking at it, this is no Hoover Dam. This is a megawatt or two, maybe? It's a little thing. You know, it's a little waterfall with a, you know, let's see, judging by the medieval-looking structure next to it, it's not even 10 meters high. No. No, okay. And then on the back of it, of all weird things, there's an advertisement for their fiber-to-the-user internet service, which is great, but it tells you that an advantage of fiber-to-the-user internet is that it saves carbon dioxide. In what way does it save emissions? If anything, the opposite, because it allows you to download stuff faster, which means there need to be more servers to serve it to you. Anyway, so I got really angry, or at least upset, disappointed, disgusted. Disgusted might be the word. I got disgusted with this thing, because it's just so much double talk. So much double talk, not real solutions. And at the same time, we had the news, right? We had the news from Egypt, from Sharm el-Sheikh. Let me read this to you, because it's hard to believe that you can do it. A failure to mention all fossil fuels. This is Deutsche Welle, by the way, the English language surface of the German radio news people. A failure to mention all fossil fuels in the latest UN climate agreement draft text has outraged delegates in Egypt, who are demanding immediate action to keep global heating to 1.5 degrees centigrade. With negotiations at COP27 likely to carry on into the weekend, the latest text repeats the diluted language brokered at the 2021 Glasgow Climate Summit to, quote, phase down so-called, quote, unabated coal power. It does not mention oil and gas. Quote, if this COP doesn't extend the phase out beyond coal, it's a failure, said Nikki Reich, Director of Climate and Energy at the U.S.-based Center for Environmental Law. The weaker language of a phase down as opposed to phase out also leaves, quote, tanker-sized loopholes for further fossil fuel projects, she said at COP27, such as the big oil projects in Africa that I've mentioned before on this show, including the one at Lake Albert, which is pumping something that's going to require the world's longest heated pipeline. It's described as waxy. By Friday morning, both the EU and the Independent Association of Latin American and Caribbean Countries had called for the phase-out of all fossil fuels in the text, according to Climate Action Network International, which brings together 1,800 civil society groups from around the world. A proposal by Pacific Island state Tuvalu for all nations to phase out fossil fuel production and consumption and achieve 100% renewable energy by 2050 was agreed by all parties during the overnight negotiations, even if delegates from Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iran, USA, and EU members Hungary and Poland were not completely supportive. Meanwhile, CAN reported that the EU, UK, Australia, Canada, and other fossil fuel exporters such as Norway, UAE, and Kuwait have agreed to stop any new fossil fuel projects. Campaigners questioned the wording of a push to transition to, quote, low-emission energy systems. This is an opening door for continued promotion of fossil fuels instead of a shift to renewable energy, tweeted an attorney from the Center for Environmental Law. Well, again, this is remarkably cheap. This is remarkably cheap talk, okay? Remarkably cheap talk, because the plain fact is, nobody has yet proposed anything resembling a coherent plan which would replace with renewables the 63%, 17,000 terawatt hours, of current electricity generation that is provided from fossil fuels. Nobody has yet even talked about the, guess what, 80%, 80%? Nearly 80%, nearly 80%. 77%, 77% of world final energy consumption, which is not in the form of electricity. This is cheap talk. When we look at changes in the global energy system, right, we look at changes in global energy use since from 1973 to 2019. What do we find? We find, for example, that of the increase in electricity production over that whole time period, 36% has been made up by coal increasing. 27% has been made up by gas increasing. 14% 15% has been made up by hydro increasing, 12% has been made up by fission, 14% has been made up by other stuff increasing. That's impressive, okay. But 14% isn't anything like 100%. Think about it. Think about it. Please, please, please. Okay. So yeah, and you look at the increase of energy use from 1973 to 2019, right? That final consumption. Now, only 33% of the increase in final consumption, 34%, has been made up by electricity. 66% has been made up by combustibles. Well, electricity and others, including district heating, solar, water heating, and that kind of thing. ZDR Monster says, please do what? That's a comment in com. Think. When somebody comes to you saying, oh, we're going to replace all that nasty fossil fuels with renewable energy, for example, ask them for details. They won't be able to provide any because there are none. So all this that you hear, all these announcements, oh yes, we're going to set such and such goals, they don't mean anything because there is no basis on which they can be executed. And so yes, I get a bit disturbed by that. So I have to ask, what do we need to do? What would constitute real solutions to these problems? Thinking about it a lot. And I think one thing that we need is what I would call a decade of retrenchment. Now, when I say retrenchment, I'm not talking about austerity. I'm not talking about cutting people's salaries, right? I'm talking about redirecting as much effort as possible to the places where there are well-known deficiencies. As a simple example, right? Everybody knows that in the United States, you know, the American Institution of Civil Engineers publishes every year a what they call an infrastructure report card, which basically says the bridges are falling into disrepair, roads are falling into disrepair, rail lines are falling into disrepair, water systems need replacing, sewer systems need replacing, etc. Well, maybe we should take 10 years and really back off, right? Think about that for a minute. Think about in software. You know, computers consume an enormous amount of energy these days, and a lot of that is down to very inefficient programming practices. If we took programmers and gave them 10 years, where instead of sprinting to push new products out the door every 6 weeks, they concentrated on making the stuff that's already out there work and use less energy by running on the same hardware, so you don't have to replace the hardware, which of course costs a lot of energy to make and raw materials to make, in order to reduce energy consumption, right? Wouldn't we stand a better chance? It's remarkable that in the middle of the 20th century, here's a funny thing. Electricity is so efficient at doing work, and electrification, electric power plants, got so fuel efficient so rapidly, going from about 5% to about 40% in a couple of decades, that final energy consumption in the world actually increased markedly during periods when overall fuel consumption was flat. That's not happening now, right? You know, quite aside from the question of replacing the existing world energy supply, we also have to budget for roughly doubling it, even if we're going to do the minimum of things like seawater desalting and high energy recycling practices that I have talked about on this show before. Even the absolute minimum to get us to those sustainable development goals with any chance of not wrecking the world environment. We have to increase energy consumption enormously. Anyway, you've been listening to A Step Farther Out on Anon Radio, a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 761.
7 6